Good morning again. Just for the record, this is between husband and wife in the Bible. Men are from Mars, women are from Venus. The first day of this unit, Sefer Breshit on Ha'isha V'Adam. What did you say, excuse me?
How did we end up on Earth then?
How did we end up here? We're not on Earth. Okay. It's no secret to anyone in this room that the verses we learned this morning in Chavruta and that we're about to continue learning have played an extremely central role in, I would say, the development and the nature of Western culture. It's no secret that through much of the history of Western culture, on some level, in some sense, women have been considered to be inferior, to be subservient, to be secondary, to be less than men in some sense, in some way. And that's only at the beginning of changing in the generation we live in. And it also might not be a secret that to a large degree, the subservient place of women in Western society has been connected to these verses. In Judaism, and even more in Christianity, these verses that we just read this morning, reading right now, have been taken as a program and as a proof that women are not like men, that women are secondary to men, that women are inferior to men, in some sense, on some level. And it's been understood very, very strongly and mainstreamly in Christianity and also in Judaism that the curse, v'hu yimshol bach, and he shall rule over you, has been understood programmatically. That's the way it is. That's the nature of things. That's the way things should be. And when we read that the Isha took of the forbidden fruit, ate it, and gave to her husband, well, you see the generic weakness of womankind. And you see that they can't be trusted. And you see that man must rule over her. And on the other hand, I think that we'll see in this room, just like you began seeing for the past 2 hours, we begin seeing a different approach. A different approach to the whole thing. A different understanding to the whole thing. Like I hinted in the introduction, and it's written on the sheets I gave you, there are pshatim hamitchadshim dechol yom. There are interpretations, there are insights, there are understandings that are being developed, that are being created, that are being uncovered, that are being teased out of the text in every generation. And we've merited to live in a generation in which the hachamim of the generation, and we ourselves, just like the hachamim of the generation, are somehow, for some reason, able to see things in this text that previous generations didn't see. And again, I think that we'll see things that undermine everything I just said for the past 5 minutes, undermine this understanding that women are essentially and inherently and are meant to be secondary and inferior. Here we go! Okay. You guys all read the verses. We know the story. Let's begin. And I'm going to do it very, very straightforwardly and simply, going through the verses according to the questions I gave you and flesh out an interpretation that might not be the only interpretation, but I think it's a very, very plausible one and a meaningful one and a pregnant one and ultimately one that speaks to me. A good deal of what we're going to say is based upon insights of the man behind the woman who founded Nishmat, Rabbi Yehuda Hankin. He's the one from whom I first learned to see these verses in a fashion to a large degree different than the way Christians and many Jews have seen them for at least 2,000 years, if not longer. So, we begin with verse 18, verse Yudchet. And verse Yudchet says, I'll read it in Hebrew and English, it says, V'yomer Adonai Elohim, lo tov heyot adam levado, eselo ezer kinegdo. So God says, that it's low toll for man to be alone, I will make for him an ezer kenegdo. And the big question that arises is, well, there's lots of big questions. Let's start with a secondarily big question, which is, did man experience existential loneliness, or did he not? And it's possible to say that he didn't. Because the verse says that man was told by God. That God said, okay, it doesn't say that God said to man, it says God said that it's not good for man to be alone. But it doesn't say that man said it's not good. So it might be, it's possible, and misinterpretation is brought up by a famous radio commentator of the 21st century, Dennis Prager. And have you heard of Dennis Prager? Dennis Prager points out, and I consider him to be not Gadol Hador, not the greatest rabbi that ever lived, but Dennis Prager has some interesting insights on the Torah. Dennis Prager points out that it doesn't say that man felt any existential loneliness. It doesn't say man felt any need. It says that God says that man has a need. God says that man has a need. And from here, Dennis Prager says, it might just be that the lack of completion, the lack of wholeness that is to be found in the male is unaware of that. And man requires, when I say man, I mean males, male require God to tell them, you're not complete. There's something missing from your personality. There's something that requires a completion. Something requires another being. And it turns out from the story that completion can't be supplied by an animal or even by another man, but only by a woman. And it might just be that men are unaware of their need for women. But God is aware. And that's a statement, that's a metaphysical statement. I just want to say that there's one place in this text, and I'm going to ask a question. There's one verse in the whole text we read, one verse, ready to answer the question? One verse that interrupts the narrative. There's one verse that seems like it's a kind of parenthetical insertion. Mm-hmm. Don't tell me what it is, just raise your hand if you know which verse I mean. Just what everyone knows, fine, okay. Right? So I don't have to ask for volunteers because everyone knows the verse. It says, as if it's the narrator says, interrupts the flow of the narrative, saying that therefore a man leaves his mother and father and davak beishto and clings to his wife, vayul basar achad, may become one flesh. What that one flesh means is not clear. Some commentators say it simply means that they create a child, which is the one flesh that comes from the two of them. I don't think that's the meaning of it. It seems to mean, on a simple level, that they become one as a unit, not because of any procreation, but the ideal is. And that statement seems to be a program, a necessity, that man has to leave his parents and search completion in a being outside of him, and only and that's necessary. That's necessary because, as God said, and man did not necessarily feel this, but God said that it's not good for man to be alone. Which means actually that according to this, marriage is a need of the male. The male might not know that, but it's a need of the male. And it's the divine metaphysical understanding of the only way the world will be complete. By the way, I admit that to a large degree, I'm speaking from male perspective because the story's from male perspective.
So did you know you needed to be married? Or somebody
good question. Married? Good question. I learn as the years go by how much I need an additional perspective that completes mine. That's for certain. The verses don't say if womankind is existentially in need of a man. But it says that man is in need of a woman. Martha?
Did not left my head, sorry.
Jesse.
Oh, I know.
Oh, excuse me, Jesse, she remembered.
In fact, only man is commanded to marry and procreate. Woman is not.
That's true as far as the halakha goes, that's mm-hmm. true. But there again, it's procreation. And we're not talking here about procreation, necessarily. We're just talking about...
But maybe that's what convinces men that he should get married. So this.
Right. It could be that the sexual drive, now we're getting far afield, the sexual drive is a divine tool to convince man to do what he really needs to do, which is to hook up with a woman. Yeah?
But it does say, like, if the woman will crave her husband, that's a need when you crave something.
Yes, you're right. But it's in the curse.
Right. But at the end...
But it's true, you're saying it's true. Okay, so I would like to wait half an hour for that. Because I'm not sure what it means. There might be different English translations. So you're reading from the Jerusalem Bible and it says crave?
Yeah, but I was trying to find the Hebrew word.
The Hebrew is ve'el ishech tishukatech. Towards your man is your desire or your need. We'll have to talk about what that means. Any other English translations?
That's
the very end of chapter 4.
English.
No, that's not the end, I'm sorry.
Desire.
What am I saying? The end of chapter 3. Say it again?
Desire shall be for your husband.
Okay. Urge, it says. Okay. Many of these translations are understanding it sexually. And I'm not sure that's what it really means. What does the article say?
Craving,
okay. Okay, that's getting ahead of ourselves. So anyway, we talked about the question... Is there a need, an existential need that man feels or not? Perhaps not, because it doesn't say that he feels it. Perhaps he does feel it. Rabbi Soloveitchik, Rav Yosef Ber Soloveitchik, in his commentaries on these verses, does talk about man experiencing the sense of lack of completion being levad, when he's levad. Okay, but let's go further.
Rabbi?
Yes?
I must ask you, a strange line that we have of a man leaving his parents, his father and his mother, and clinging to his wife. It's weird because we don't have the first parents yet, and we're not told necessarily that they're supposed to be the
very
father
good.
And mother.
That's a good insight.
Which is weird, and so his only relationship is to his creator, is to Akash Baruch Hu.
Yeah, good. So your comment only underlines what I said earlier, that is not part of the narrative. That, in a certain sense, is the redactor, God's insertion into the narrative, giving us a larger metaphysical and sociological perspective. That's why throughout human history, says God, that's why it has to be that men leave their parents and cling to their wives. It's part of the very fabric of the way man is created. Yeah, that's a very good point. Okay, so in Charuta, I managed to talk to many of you about the next question on my sheet number 2, which is why is it that God feels, or that also man feels, that it's not good to be alone. What's so bad about being alone? And remember, as we talked about in the Chavrutot, it can't be that man is looking at the animals and saying they all have female companions, because there are no animals yet. This is just man. This is just man in the garden. That's all there is. So why is it not good to be alone? So some commentators point out that if you want to take this seriously, you have to look in the text and see what is it that man's supposed to be doing. Then you understand what he might need help with. So, all of you know what it was, the two things that man had to do. So, someone who wasn't in a chavruta that I talked to you about this, but someone else.
Well, he's been told to look after the garden. He's also...
Right, look after it, you said.
Yeah, and he's also been told to be fruitful and multiply.
Oh! Who knows what I'll respond to someone who says that there's something called being fruitful and multiply. What am I going to respond?
Later.
Earlier.
It's in
chapter 1.
Right, it's in chapter 1. Yeah. And without explaining the whole theology behind it, chapter 1 and chapter 2 seems to be two different stories. So I'm acting as if chapter 1 isn't there.
Okay, well he's told to look after the garden.
Look after the garden, right? La'ovda v'lishomra. To garden keep it as one of his tasks. What's his other task? It's a negative task.
Not to eat.
Right? So we're going to say like this. Man has two tasks. One is to look after the garden, la'obda l'shomra, and the other is to refrain from eating from the forbidden tree. Now I'm going to ask myself the following question. Of those two tasks that both might require help, which of the two is the one because of which God says, Lo tov heyot adam levado. It's not good for man to be alone. Which of the two? And you can really prove from the text which of the two it is. You can prove it. Not guess. You can prove from the text which of those two is the reason for which woman was created. Who can prove it?
perhaps it was the idea, so you, like you said, it was taking care of the garden and not to eat from the tree. These were two tasks. To take care of the garden, he was giving the animals. And something that it said, it showed that like he was able to name them.
Mm-hmm.
He was able to define them. He had another power, and it was like he was able to take care, right, of that aspect, and it was more for them.
So you are right. But I think it could be said in a fashion that makes it clearer. Anyone else? The answer certainly does have something to do with the animals, just like Josie said. But you can say it clearer.
Well, some of the animals would have done a better job of helping take care of the garden.
Right, right. In other words, God said it's not good for man to be alone. And God made the animals. If the need for which God said it's not good to be alone was to take care of the garden, then the minute God created two oxen, man should have said, great! Or God should have said, great, exactly what we needed.
Or go to trim the grass.
Yeah. But at the moment the animals were created, no one said, that's just what we needed. So apparently, the need wasn't an agricultural need, it wasn't a physical need, because the animals could have done that much better than the woman who was created later. Still, an ox can plow better than a woman. Sorry if I sound a little bit...
better than a man, too.
Right, better than a man. So it must be there's a different need. It must be that the need was the reason why God said that lo tov heyot adam levado, that it's not good for man to be alone. It must have been for the moral need of aid in overcoming temptation. And there's another proof for that, which is that God says that it's not good for man to be alone only after God gives the command not to eat. Notice the sequence. Notice the sequence. First, God creates the garden. And God says that man should, lovdav l'shomra, should take care of it. And at that point, after God said take care of it, God doesn't say, it's not good for man to be alone. Rather, what first happens? The command is given not to eat. And then God says, it's not good to be alone. So that's a second proof that the need, the matter of not being alone, is based directly on the command to not eat.
What does lo tov l'shomra mean? What's he guarding it? And the curse later says that he has to toil, so he didn't have to toil in the Garden of Eden. So what is God telling
us? For that, let's go back to the very beginning of the chapter. I think we should look in chapter 2, verse 5. I'll read it in English. And no plant of the field was yet in the earth, and no herb of the field had yet grown, for the Lord God had not caused his rain upon the earth, and there was not a man to till the ground. The Hebrew there, to till the ground, is
la'avod et
adama. So, In some sense, man was supposed to be doing some work. And I assume that when it later says that man is there la'ovdav l'shomra, to work it and keep it, well, that word la'ovdav is the same word it says here in verse 5, to la'vod et adama. So it still looks like, just one second, looks like, on the simplest level, to garden and keep it. La'ovdav l'shomra is part of, it's an expansion of, it's basically the same thing as what it said at the beginning of chapter, in verse 5, la'avod et adama. There is some tilling, there is some work that has to be done. The curse is that work is going to be difficult.
And thistles.
But it doesn't mean there was no work before that to be done. Is that a, does make sense?
Lishmor doesn't mean to guard.
We'd have to ask ourselves, is there anything to guard it against? And we don't know of anything in the story to guard it against, so I would assume that it means not guarding against, but guarding in the sense of perhaps weeding. In other words, preventing it from going downhill. La'avod is to positively till it. L'shomra is to keep it in good situation. That's my guess. Shot. Without any commentators, without any depth, mysticism, philosophy, just shot.
One has the tool and things like that. You can do that. You don't necessarily have to be pulling out weeds when there's no thorns and thistles and things yet.
Again, I would say it's a matter of degree. The curse is there's going to be lots of thorns and thistles and it's going to be difficult to keep up. That doesn't mean that beforehand there was no work to be done. It was just a moderate amount of work, less.
Yeah.
Sitting next to Hedy is Rivka. Rivka, you wanted to say something like that?
It's supposed to work, like we're reading, and it's supposed to work the soil, but I mean, we have Adam working the Adama, working himself in some way. And I've heard that there's like there's obviously this big connection between rain here and work, and I mean, studying Tani, this connection of prayer and work of the heart and bringing water. But in some ways that man is in some ways working himself, like Adam, Adama.
Well, it seems that part of his purpose, his main purpose in this particular story, is directly connected to the Adama, directly connected to the earth, to the garden, and that's why the curse is so serious, because it gets him exactly where his purpose is. Right? This man in this story is part of the natural order, not like the first chapter of Bereshit, which is above the natural order. In this particular story, he's part of the natural order, and his purpose is to keep the garden up. Okay, so let me just go back to where we were.
Maybe it's, from what I understand what you're saying, it's also to keep himself up.
Well,
Because he's made out of earth.
Mm-hmm. Okay,
so
okay.
So it might also be, and then he needs the desert connector to help him keep himself up, to guard himself from temptation.
Okay, okay. Okay, so if you've helped us to come back to where I want to go, which is again, okay, so... If it's so that of the two tasks that man has, it's specifically for the task of refraining from eating from the forbidden fruit that he needs help, well, that teaches us something about the moral and ethical incompleteness of malekind. That he has some type of yetzer hara, some type of temptation, some type of moral weakness, some type of curiosity that might get the better of him, and he needs help in overcoming that temptation. Specifically, not eat the forbidden fruit, but by expansion, that man needs help in all of the moral and ethical issues of life.
I don't know if it's related, but I was just curious. It's written, the idea of protection is the idea of guidance, and it's the idea of, like, not control, but the woman basically saying it's created in order for him, like, to make an ethical debate, to lead him in that way. And like when you see she's created from the rib, and the rib in the body is what protects the organs.
Uh-huh.
So is there a relation?
I never thought of that. It's really not clear if it's the rib or the side.
Yeah.
Okay. I'll put on the table for thought.
But then when you look at nowadays the dynamics, the idea of protection always comes from the man.
Right.
Right? Like the man is...
Well, the physical protection, but perhaps there's a moral protection. Okay, so once we've established, and again, it might not be proven, but it's quite plausible, and it makes a lot of sense, that man's need was moral for help in overcoming temptation, then we move on to the question of what is the Ezer Kenegdo? It says it's not good for him to be alone, he needs an Ezer Kenegdo. And we have to understand that in the context of the need that he has, this moral need. Okay, so Ezer Kenegdo. We know the word Ezer. That's good, means help. It's a noun from the verb that means to help. And the word Kenegdo, it means Keneged, which is one word. Kenegdo, Keneged him. This Ezer has to be Keneged him. And some of you, I talked in Harut about this, some of you discovered yourselves, that this word... Keneged in biblical Hebrew in the whole Tanakh is what's called the Mila Yechidait, a singular word. There is no other appearance of this word in the whole Tanakh, in the whole Bible. I didn't say there's no appearances of the word Neged, but this is Keneged with a Kuf there. Keneged, that word Keneged is one word. Appears no place else in the Tanakh. Now, many of you might know that one of the major tools we have for understanding a word in context is seeing where it appears in other contexts and see if we can compare one to the other. But now we have a problem. When you have a Mila Yechidait, has no other appearances in the whole Tanakh, you have a problem. If you can't understand it in the context you have it, then how do you figure it out? We have a problem. You could look at other languages. As far as I know, we don't have Akkadian or Assyrian that can help us with this word. And therefore, we have no choice but to look at later Hebrew, at Rabbinic Hebrew. Now, the minute I look at Rabbinic Hebrew to understand a language of 1,000 years earlier, even 2,000 years earlier, I have a problem. Because language is developed. And the meaning the word has in late Hebrew might not be the same as in the Biblical Hebrew. But it's all I have. I have no choice but to try to look in Biblical Hebrew. And like we said in some of the Charutot, in Rabbinic Hebrew, many of you know that there's a phrase, Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. The study of Torah is equal to all of them. All of them meaning all other mitzvot. There are many mitzvot with great reward, but Talmud Torah is Keneged Kulam. And this use of the word Keneged as meaning equal, equivalent, the same, like, is found again and again and again in Rabbinic Hebrew. There's no other meaning to the phrase. In Rabbinic Hebrew, Keneged means equal. And our
Talmud Torah is equal to all?
Talmud Torah is equal to all the other mitzvot. Right? Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam. All of them, all the other mitzvot. Now, in the context of our verse, in which we said that the woman was created to serve as a moral aid for the man in his efforts to overcome his temptation and curiosity to eat the fruit, she was created as an Ezer Kenegdo, meaning a helper equal to him, or a helper like him, or a helper equivalent to him, everything makes sense. Because we understand that for a human being to serve another human being as a moral aid, as someone that can help you and talk to you and convince you and show you that you should overcome your need to have another piece of cake, overcome your need to do this or to do that, we all know that you don't take advice from a dog. You don't take advice from a 5-year-old child. You can only really learn morally from someone that you respect, who is on the same wavelength as you, who has the same needs and wants and desires and aspirations and loves as you have. Only someone who's really just like you can help you in this. I mean, excuse me for the example, Weight Watchers, Alcoholics Anonymous, who can help you in moral challenges? People who have the same challenges and who you respect, who can overcome them, who can give you edud, can give you encouragement because you're on the same level, because you respect each other. Yes?
You teach the same thing to guys. Do you teach the same thing to guys?
I have no choice. It's Torah Hashem. I can't disguise things. So, if that's what it means, then I admit that many, many generations of Jews and Christians have not read it like this. But that's what it seems to say. And through my eyes, to be more exact, through the eyes of Rav Hankin, who first pointed this out to me, an Ezer Kenegdo can only be someone that you respect, that you have a deep, deep even admiration for, who you know to have the weaknesses that you have, but also has strengths that you respect and you're willing to listen to him or to her. You see this person as having some type of authority, some type of importance, some type of significance in your life. Otherwise, he or she is not going to be an Ezer Kenegdo, certainly not on the moral level that we're talking about.
It's a tangent, but it's bugging my memory and I didn't have a chance to look at the source.
That I might say...
The four sons, doesn't that use Kenegdo? Keneged Arba Banim Divra Torah?
Yes. Wow. Keneged Arba.
I don't see how that fits.
Okay, let me... What's the context? What's the whole line?
Haggadah.
And there's the first word of the sentence. Keneged Arba Banim.
Right. I mean, what's the...
And there it means about. There it means about. Give me a second. Wow. You stumped me. Okay, what do you say?
What we discussed was that the Mepharshim say that connected there means that you have to teach each one in a way he'll understand. So
you have to stand opposite each in order to... Okay.
Okay,
I like that.
And the same thing here, you can say, you have to know what's going on in his brain to be able to give him advice that he'll take.
Yeah, I hear. Okay, so you're trying to save me. But the truth is, I think it's a good effort, but I really want to think about this more. You know,
it's a different word. It's connected and connect up.
But that shouldn't matter, because connect, the O at the end is simply a suffix of connected what?
It's a pronoun.
There's no other connected in the whole Tanakh.
There's none of that.
Right?
Rav Henkin tried. I tried. They tried. Yeah. Okay, so that, I will give it more thought. Okay, so where are we now? Where are we now? We are on... so we basically talked right about question 3, which is why do the animals not work as an Ezra Kenegdel? Now we understand completely, right? If the purpose of this creation was to help man with the farming, then the animals would have been fine. But if the purpose was the things we've been talking about, then it's clear why the animals are not going to be any type of help. And that's pretty simple. And we also did question 4 about where we see this phrase in rabbinic literature and what does it mean, how does it fit here. And then we get the question...
What about Megan, Kinecto, Midah,
Kineged Midah. So there, it's exactly what we're talking about, right? Mm-hmm. It's Midah equal to Midah. That if anyone's not familiar, the phrase midah keneged midah in rabbinic literature means basically punishment or consequences of an evil deed that is tit for tat. You get what you dish out. If you did evil through water, you'll be punished through water. If you did evil through murder, you'll be killed, etc. And there, indeed, I should thank Zimra. Okay. I should thank Zimra for that example. Midah keneged midah means midah characteristic, an aspect equal to an aspect.
So you've got this balance.
You get what you dish out.
It's balanced. Then
Not. Okay. So let's go on.
Yeah.
Okay. So where are we so now? Number 5 was in verse 23. Let's look at verse 23. Verse 23 says in Hebrew, V'yomer Adam, man said, Zot hapam, this is it. Etzem yatzamai, a bone from my bone, uvasari desari, and flesh from my flesh, lezot yikere isha, to this will be called isha. And again, isha is ish, with a hey at the end, the feminine ish. Ki mi'ish u'kahazot, because from ish, was this creature taken. So man is overjoyed at the creation of woman specifically because she is from his flesh and from his bones, because she is like him, that's why he likes her. In other words, it's the similarity between the two of them that so excites man. He's not looking, again, I'm just repeating myself now, not looking for a beast of burden for that you don't need something similar to you. He's not looking for some type of technical aid for that you don't need something similar to you. If what he wants is something similar to him, then what he's looking for is conversation. What he's looking for is companionship. What he's looking for is some type of, again, creature, some type of moral creature who's made from the same cloth as him, who can help him with his deepest, deepest issues and problems and self-doubts.
What's the significance here? This is the, you may notice this is the first time that we have Ish and Isha. Both for man and woman. We don't have it in the first
I'm happy you asked the question. Because one of the most famous, most well-known religious Bible scholars of the 20th century, there were two of them. One was Professor Nachama Leibowitz, who I was very close to, and the other was Professor Nachum Sarna, who I was also very close to. And I want to tell you what Professor Sarna said about this. Professor Sarna, who passed away just, I think, 3 years ago, he pointed out that this verse we're looking at right now, verse 23, it's the first time, I don't remember if it's the first time that the word Ish is used, it's the first time Ish is used? It's the first time Ish is used. Who uses the word Ish? The Ish. The Ish uses the word Ish. In other words, this verse is about self-discovery. He only knows who he is when? When there's an isha. You can make beautiful drashot, you can give a sermon in synagogue like that, right? But it's true, it's true. He only calls himself ish when he has an isha. Rivka. Oh, sorry?
Oh, no, the other thing we noticed was that, like, yeah, like, isha even comes before the word ish.
Oh, does it?
Yeah.
Let me see. You're right. Uh-huh. So these are necrophetic.
Yeah. And the other thing is that it splits up again. Like, we have this beautiful line where we're using both the ish and the isha in Chof Gimel and Chof Dalet.
Mm-hmm. 23 and 24.
And then right away again, we go back to Ha'adam, v'ishto. And it's mm-hmm. weird because you've got this, like, this... Here you have this beautiful image, it feels like, at first, of this equality and this deep respect for the woman and this mm-hmm. recognition mm-hmm. of oneself in the woman.
Mm-hmm.
And then right away we get back to this strict division of Adam but Ishto. This is my wife. And I am Adam.
Uh-huh.
I'm very separate from her in some ways.
Exactly. So it's only in the words of the Ish and in the words of the narrator above, in that verse we said is parenthetical, verse 24, it's only in 23 that's man speaking, and 24 that is the God narrator speaking, that Ish and Isha have those parallel terms, whereas in the stories it flows, the language is different.
Even today, mm-hmm. you talk about husbands, Baal, but you talk about wives as Isha.
Ooh, right, there's a verse in the prophet Hosea, who says in the future, a woman will not call her husband a husband, well, she'll call him my ish. Right? Not Bali, but Ishi. And that's for Yemot HaMashiach. We'll mention that perhaps another, I guess, 20 minutes, but it's a good point. Okay, let's see. Going back again, where are we? Okay. We talked about verse 24. Right? We've talked about that. Okay. I'm going to skip question 8, because although it's important and interesting, it's not directly related to our topic. That's the use of the word erom, which means naked and simple. I'm sorry, the opposite. It means naked and sophisticated.
Mm-hmm. And wildly.
We won't go into that. Let's start getting into the meat of things at the beginning of chapter 3. Chapter 3, the first verse says, "Vanachash haya arom mikol hayat hasadeh," etc. And the nachash was cunning of all the animals that God had made, and he said to the woman, how does the English say it? "Ach ki amar Elokim lo tochlu mikol eitz hagan." Indeed, God said, don't eat from all of the trees of the garden. Now, as we begin to read the story, with the insight that we've already garnered, we should be pretty confused. Because it turns out, as we know from the story, that it was, as it were, woman's fault, as it were, and woman's weakness, as it were, that causes the downfall of man. And we understand that that's even worse than we thought before we started learning. Because we've just learned that her whole purpose was to prevent man from eating, and it ends up that it specifically caused the part that he did eat. That's like really bad. So perversion of the whole thing, so it seems. So let's start getting into that. What the snake does, what the nahash does, in order to gain her confidence, is to show he knows what's going on. Right? He knows this God stuff, he knows about this command stuff, he gets her confidence, he has some knowledge, just like she has knowledge, but he exaggerates. He goes overboard, and he puts her on the defensive. So she has to speak up, she has to get into the conversation and say, no, God didn't say that we can't eat anything. God isn't as bad. He's not just a tyrant like the snake says. She has to defend God, as it were. And she goes on to say, I'm going to read the next verse now, verse 2, and the woman said to the serpent, "We may eat of the fruit of the trees of the garden, but of the fruit of the tree which is in the midst of the garden, betocha agan, in the middle of the garden, God has said, you shall not eat of it, neither shall you touch it, lest you die." And here we come to the big question. Where did she get this from when she says that if you touch it, not just if you eat it, but if you even touch it, you'll die? Now that's wrong, and it's not true, and it's made up. But the question is, who made it up? Broken telephone. Exactly, right? That's exactly what we have to say right now, because woman was created after the command was given. So there's only one way she knows about this command, which is through her husband. So we have two possibilities. Say it again.
She could have exaggerated herself.
Right. Either she exaggerated or he exaggerated. And we have to figure out who did it. We have to figure out who exaggerated, she or he. Well, let's try and think. Do we have any hints from the text of who it was? Who exaggerated? We don't really have any hints. But we can talk about motivation. Does anyone have any motivation for exaggerating? Does the woman have motivation? Does the man have motivation?
Man.
What would his motivation be?
He wants to make it stronger.
Why?
To make sure that she doesn't...
To make sure.
Good darling.
Isn't that from a viewpoint afterwards? What does he have not to trust her?
Very good point.
What's his reference point?
That's good. In other words, she was created to help him, which requires respect, requires a communication, requires a free flow of knowledge and information and feelings. So why would he kind of subvert all that by trying to put a fence around the tree and tell her to stay away, don't even touch it, and even to misrepresent God's words and to say that God said don't touch it? And like, Ryan, what's your name?
Sharon.
Right. Sharon said, in a certain sense, this is man acting according to the curse. But everything's supposed to be different now. Good questions.
But we see that, like, it's like the man thinks he's taking God's word and changing them,
mm-hmm.
right?
Yeah.
To a certain point, if he feels he can do that, is it wrong for him to say that maybe there was a relationship between what God said? Like, he made God's word his own, right? Who is he to change those words? And, like, I don't know.
Okay, that's a good question. Yes.
But also he seems to have left out part of what Hashem said about that this was the tree of the knowledge of good and evil.
Very good. Okay, so that's a good idea. Let's put on the table everything you just said to get back to it in 2 minutes, and let's go to something else because the things will, I think, come together. It's not just that the woman has extra information, whether it came from the man or came from her, that you can't eat it and you can't even touch it, but it's also that she's missing information, right? Because she doesn't know to identify the tree by its name. She just says the tree over there, the tree in the middle of the garden. She doesn't call it by its name. Now that's really difficult. That's problematic. Why shouldn't she use its name? Now its name, of course, is indicative of its essence. The tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what it does is apparently provide knowledge of good and evil. And she doesn't know its name. I assume that if she knew its name, she'd call it. It would be easier to use its name.
Does that represent the importance of education for women?
How did you know? So we don't have enough time to go to all the places we can go with this. Exactly. So let's try and put things together. The fact that she doesn't know the name of the tree, that can't be her fault. And she's not as forgetful as I am with names, right? She must have laughed. It seems pretty clear that the Ish didn't tell her the name of the tree. And you can all think of good reasons why her husband didn't tell her the name of the tree. Because the man is drawn to this tree. He has a yetzer to have knowledge of good and evil. He wants to eat from this tree. And he's looking to guidance for his wife to help him refrain from eating from the tree. And he wants to help her to help him. He wants to help her to refrain. He wants to help her overcome the yetzara that he assumes the tree has, because he has that yetzara. And therefore, he refrains from telling her the allure of the tree. He doesn't want to arouse her curiosity, arouse her yetzara. He's trying to protect her. And if he's trying to protect her by not telling her the great values of this tree that gives you knowledge of good and evil, and he just says that that's some tree over there who knows what it's about, doesn't really matter, just stay away from it. While he's protecting her by not telling her the allure of the tree, he also protects her by telling her, you know what? God said not to eat it and not even to touch it. Let's stay far away from here. So it turns out, I think, that the man is exhibiting a certain deep weakness. Let me finish the thought because it's getting late. I apologize. He is unawares subverting the very purpose for which his wife was created.
Yeah, that's what I'm
saying. Then I'm sorry I didn't let you say it. Right. Because to be an Ezer Kenegdo requires respect, requires a sense of mutual equality, requires communication, requires a free flow of information. She cannot be what she's supposed to be unless she knows exactly what God said and what God didn't say, and knows exactly what this tree is and why it should be a matter of allure and curiosity and of yetzer. But if she doesn't have that information, she can't do what she's supposed to do. So the point I'm trying to make is, and again, we haven't proven it, but it's pretty plausible in the text. It's pretty clear. This is a very, very, in my mind, possible and plausible explanation that it ends up that man took from woman the tools and the ability to serve as the Ezer Kenegdo that she was supposed to serve as. Yes, she's the one that gave him the forbidden fruit, but in the end, it turns out she did it, and we have to get to that now, she did it because she was subverted in her purpose by man. How did this happen? So let's go further. She doesn't know the name of the tree. She doesn't know the nature of the tree. She doesn't feel towards the tree the same allure that her husband feels because she doesn't know what it is. And she also thinks that God said, don't eat it and don't even touch it. And then, how does the Nahash get the better of her? By showing her that he knows more than she does. That he is in the know. Perhaps he has a closer connection, the snake, to God than she does. And then she realizes that her husband withheld information from her. The snake says that this tree is, how does it say exactly? It's good to become enlightened by. Let's look at that verse. That's in chapter 3. The snake says, in verse 4 and 5, you shall surely, and the serpent said to the woman, you shall not surely die. And that he's lying. For God knows on the day that you eat of it, then your eyes shall be opened, you shall be as gods, knowing good and evil. That's the truth, that your eyes will be opened, knowing good and evil. He says something that she never heard of. And suddenly she realizes, like I said 2 minutes ago, that her husband withheld something from her. And that's painful. That brings up a whole sense of he doesn't value me. He doesn't respect me. He withheld information from me. He doesn't trust me. Who can I talk to? I can talk to the Nahash. I can't talk to my husband. And there's a certain gap that's created here between man and woman. It's, again, a very perversion of the whole purpose that she's here on earth. And from then, it's downhill. There's a famous midrash that says, and you can look at it on this page, that some of you, almost all of you have, there's a famous midrash that says, in my bracket, when the snake saw her passing by the tree, he took and thrust her against it. Have you then died, he said to her? Just as you were not stricken through touching it, so you will not die when you eat of it. But God doth know that in the day that you eat of it, you'll have knowledge of good and evil. In this class, I'm not asking us to take the Midrash literally. I'm not saying that the Midrash has any authority over our understanding of the pshat of the verses. But we can see that the Midrash has the same approach that we've been looking at for the past half an hour. Because if the snake pushed her against the tree, and she was startled that she didn't die, and she realizes, then God's word seems to be worthless, and therefore she goes to eat it, because if I didn't die when I touch it, I guess I won't die when I eat it. If for this ploy of the snake to work, it couldn't be that she made up the fence that says you can't touch it. She must have thought that God said that, which means she got it from her husband. He misrepresented, the husband misrepresented God's word to her, and she suddenly realizes that she doesn't have a full picture when she's pushed against the tree and she doesn't die. She sees she doesn't have a full picture of reality. Her husband has not respected her. There hasn't been full communication. There hasn't been full disclosure. And she is, to a certain degree, I would think, despondent. Her whole purpose, her whole meaning is gone. He doesn't trust me.
How can we read that, though? I mean, because part of the perspective could be simply like, he told me not to touch it. He doesn't really know what's, he doesn't really know what's going on. Otherwise, we're both in the dark here. And she helps him, which makes more sense.
She helps her husband?
Of course, by giving him the fruit. I mean, she thinks that really, like, he didn't know anything about this. You know, we've been left totally in the dark. He told me not to touch it. This is what. How does she not assume that this is all he knows? Well, don't touch it. I don't know what it is.
Do you know what?
She might not even. So she might not even feel sad. Which is why, I mean, very simply, it seemed that she's like, "Oh, it's not a bad thing. It's a good thing. Let me give. I want to help my husband."
You could be right, and if you're right, I don't think that subverts any of the insights that we've seen here.
But did he knew what he was doing when he ate it. It says he was there with her and he ate it. So wouldn't he have been knowing that what he was doing?
Did he know what he was doing?
It seems she was...
Does the text say that he knew that he was eating the forbidden fruit?
It's not clear.
He knew what he was doing.
I don't know. What do you guys say? Did the husband, did the man know that he was eating of the forbidden fruit? Let me think for a second. Well, when God comes and rebukes them, what does God say?
Did you eat from the tree that told you not to?
He says, yeah, she gave me.
So he does seem to know that he did.
Yeah. Right? But does he know that he does from the fact that his eyes are opened?
Mm-hmm.
Like,
okay.
You know then, like, is it just a simple, like, so much ignorance and chaos leads us into a sin that only afterwards, once we go through the sin and we feel the spiritual consequences.
That could be. But in any case, the basic outlines here seem to be clear. And notice that even though I said that what we're looking at is a modern insight, it turns out that the Midrash from 2,000 years ago does seem to be very, very cognizant of the fact that it was the fence that the man put up for his wife that ultimately is the downfall of both of them. That's very powerful. And that gets to, like Jesse said, about education. Unless you have the facts, you can't be an independent, responsible, moral creature. And when we're talking about male-female relations, this is all about communication. It's also about connecto. It's all about equality in the sense of sharing information and sharing responsibility. And that is subverted by the male need to control. He thinks that she's weak. He thinks that she needs guidance. He thinks that she needs a husband. A husband in the sense of someone who husbands, of someone who takes care of. In other words, from the very outset, he doesn't allow her to be Isha. Isha who is an Ish of the feminine type. Now, when I say that he doesn't allow her the equality that would have allowed her to be what she should have been, I don't mean to say that men and women are the same. What she was meant to be and what she needed to be for the two of them to succeed in the moral task were for her to be a feminine Ish. Feminine is different than masculine, but it's the same matrix, the same basis, the communication, the understanding, the knowledge, the information, from a different perspective, from a feminine perspective. I'm not defining what that means, but it's clear from the story that the man didn't need another man. He needed a woman. He needed someone with a different perspective. And again, he didn't allow that perspective to serve the goal and to serve the means that it was supposed to serve. Let's see what else we have to add here, because there's a lot to say. So the whole downfall went forth from this mistaken understanding of man's vis-a-vis woman's role. And then we get to the curse. They're cursed. They're cursed for eating the fruit. They're cursed. The snake is cursed. The man is cursed. The woman is cursed. As I said to someone in Chavruta, the curse of the man that the earth will bring forth its fruit only through the sweat of your brow. Judaism has always understood that to be a curse and not to be a program, not to be a given. It's rather a curse to be overcome. Jews are allowed to engage in modern agriculture and to try and sweat a little bit less in the fields. And the same thing goes for the curse to the woman. The curse is that you will bring forth children in pain. But there's no mitzvah in Judaism to suffer in childbirth. It's a curse to be overcome. The same thing goes for what we're talking about right now, which is, what is it, verse... Where's the curse? Verse 16. And to the woman he said, chapter 3, verse 16, and to the woman he said, I will greatly multiply the pain of thy childbearing. In sorrow thou shalt bring forth children. And thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. What is the meaning of this two-pronged phrase, thy desire shall be to thy husband, and he shall rule over thee?
So why does she get penalized for him not giving the information that...
Well, she had the critical that she wasn't supposed to eat.
Right, she did sin also. Right, let's not take away the blame. I'm just trying to share the blame, but not to remove it. Right? But anyway, in my translation there, which is the Jerusalem Bible that some of you have, it says, and yet thy desire shall be to thy husband. It says, bring forth children in pain, and yet thy desire. That English translation of translating the verb with a yet connects it to the previous phrase. Something X, yet something Y. It's connecting the matter of desire to thy husband to in sorrow thy bring forth children. In other words, it's saying that even though it's going to be hard to have kids, you'll still want to have sexual contact with your husband. You'll desire, in other words, it's interpreting desire on a sexual level. But Rav Hankin suggests that there's no hint in the story for any sexual context. And perhaps we should understand this phrase, thy desire shall be to thy husband. I lost it, where is it, 16? Thy desire shall be for thy husband, and he shall rule over thee. Perhaps desire has nothing to do with sexuality. Perhaps the desire should be understood in the context of he shall rule over thee. And what I mean is the following. He shall rule over thee is a curse. It's a curse that's a natural consequence. It's a curse that is a concretization of the sin. The sin was the man trying to rule over his wife, trying to help her by patronizingly denying her information, trying to deny her the temptation. He ruled over her and it backfired, because in the end it caused him to do exactly what he was trying not to do, to eat from the fruit. The curse is that the situation created by man will continue. He ruled over her. The punishment for that is to rule over her again and again and again and again. In other words, this explains to us human society as we know it. Human society as we've known it for the past thousands and thousands of years has been that to some degree men rule over women. Men control the flow of information. Men protect women, going back to the rib, in some sense or another. And that's the curse. That's the curse. And in that context, what could it mean, thy desire shall be to thy husband? What it means is that women have become complicit in the curse. That women allow men to rule over them. That women play the role, women play the cursed role of allowing their husbands to take charge. This curse, I have to tell you, is here towards the woman. She is cursed by the fact that she allows herself to play a secondary subservient role, and she's cursed by the fact that her husband buys into that. I didn't mean to say that she's the only cause of it. Her husband buys into that and lords it over her. But that curse, let me say very clearly, is not only a curse upon her. It's a curse upon men as well. Because at the same time that it does not allow women to play the role they're supposed to play, it denies men the Ezer Kenegdo that they're supposed to have. Everyone suffers. Men and women suffer from this curse. And what we have in front of us in the verses of the Torah is basically a picture of human society as we've known it for thousands of years, that men and women are cursed by the dysfunctional relationship between them. It's no secret that this has been going on for thousands of years, and it's a curse. It's true that that's the way things are, but it's not supposed to be like that. What we have in these verses is a picture saying that there is an ideal state, and it's basically never been realized, and we are suffering under a curse for thousands of years that is caused by a misunderstanding on part of man of what woman's role should be, and perhaps a misunderstanding on her part because she allows herself to be ruled, her desires to him. But ultimately, the purpose is to overcome that curse. Just like the purpose is to overcome the curse of, by the sweat of your brow you shall bring forth food from the earth, and you're supposed to overcome the curse of that in pain you'll bring forth children, we're hoping to overcome the curse that we have in front of us right here, that male and female relationships happen on this hierarchical, in this hierarchical way, that one rules over the other, which allows neither of them actually to realize their full potential and full purpose. And to me, it's just so, true. Because I know from my own life that male-female relations are the most pregnant with possibility and the most perilous with pitfalls. That's exactly what this says. It's hard to be married. It could be the greatest thing, it could be the worst thing. And that's exactly what the verse is saying. And it's all dependent upon, I shouldn't exaggerate, it's partially dependent upon a proper understanding of what the relationships are supposed to be. And let me just add, as we're supposed to finish, let me just add that a number of rabbis, a number of commentators, a number of thinkers in our generation have said that, thank God, in our generations, we are beginning to see the reversal of the curse. What's happening in this room is no doubt part and parcel of a reversal of thousands of years of curse. What happened with the fact that women got the right to vote 80 years ago? That's the other curse, right? Right? It's part of the whole thing. And a number of Zionist thinkers, followers of Rav Kook, Rav Avraham Yitzchak Cohen Kook, see this as part of, and the Lubavitcher Rebbe said the same thing, by the way, in 1991, see this as part of the unfolding Gula, the unfolding redemption. It's not just the Jewish people is being redeemed, we're coming back to our land. The whole world is in a process of uplift, a process of redemption, and that women are finally overcoming, and men are finally overcoming, this curse of dysfunctional relationships. And some have even said that the most exciting part of the unfolding redemption of our generation is actually this, reversing the matter of Hu Yimshol Bach, that he will rule over her. Yeah.
That's what the Alba says, that we say kol chatan the kol kala, right? That we hear the voice of the chatan and kala in the chuppah, that's how we know the ulah is coming. But the kala doesn't usually speak under the chuppah. So he actually says that when we start hearing the kala speak under the chuppah,
really?
It's a sign of the ulah.
Oh, very nice.
Under some got married, his wife did speak under the chuppah.
There you go. She gave the world.
It could be, I remember, it could be I don't. I'm not sure. Anyone, I'm sorry that I didn't allow them to speak as much as they wanted to. We're putting a straitjacket here. But in one more minute, 2 minutes, would anyone like to, okay?
I just have a question, like, so we could have this, we have a practical application to this philosophy in society, but I think, like, as much as women need to be educated and you need to show them that you're allowed to, not to make a step up, but to claim what's yours, like to claim that education, to claim that knowledge, I think men need to understand that need for women, you know, like, and I think women have really done the part, like, maybe not yet, but I think it goes back to the idea that, like, men, not saying men need to be more subservient, but men need to be more open, and I think that's what we need to see, because as much as we could, you know, or people could help leading the way in education and going back to that ideal, like, like there needs to be an open door from the men saying you're allowed, and that's validation, and that's your worth, like that's your pride, like go for it, you know?
I agree.
So like, I don't know.
Okay. That's why I was asking, you know, is this being taught to the men?
I have no doubt in what I've seen holding in front of an Israeli society, things are changing. Things are really developing. Okay?
Yeah. So where are we heading?